Hey, fans. Thanks for tuning in. Another fantastic week of Voice of the Fans podcast. It is February 26th. This is week 77 of Voice of the Fans podcast. In this episode, we're going to review the Deontay Wilder, Tyson Fury fight, epic fight in Las Vegas. We're also going to talk about the NFL. They had their CBA voting, the players did. They're voting this week. The owners are trying to pull a fast one on them. We're going to get Cleveland's feedback on that. We're going to have some NBA topics. The Clippers made a move, Cleveland. I know you guys are shaking. The Clippers made a couple moves here that put you guys in, that makes them number one seed Lakers in trouble. Also, I want to ask Cleveland what he thinks about Zion. Is he in the conversation? Can he possibly win the Rookie of the Year? Get his feedback on that. Also, I want to know, can somebody win the comeback player or most improved player, I should say, in the NBA? Can somebody win that 2 years in a row? That's going to be
an answer for you on that one for sure.
Okay, well, we're going to get to it. I want to shout out to the guys listening on Rise Radio out there in Las Vegas. You can hear our show on Rise Radio, which you can find on TuneIn every Saturday at 2 p.m. Or, however you're listening now, you continue to listen on any podcast platform that there is. Stitcher, Radio Public, CastBox, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. TuneIn. Find us on any one of those Voice of the Fans podcasts. As we do each and every week, it is February 26th. It is week 77. So number 26, Mr. Cleveland, who comes to your mind first when you think of number 26 or who were best?
You know, I'm going to go completely against your nerve. I know where you're going with this, so I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to say Wade Boggs. More than 26, the best. One of the greatest players in the history of baseball, World Series champion, and a Hall of Famer. I'm going to say Wade Boggs was the best.
Okay. Just totally ignoring the best cornerback or best defensive back in all of football history. Just totally ignoring that.
At least the second, probably the third, but please go with what you were going to say with that one.
No, the best. I didn't him at all. I didn't stutter, did I?
I know you didn't. I know this is a raw nerve. That's why I scratched it a little bit. Yeah.
Second
or third best defensive back of all time. Sure.
Are you cutting me off, or are you going to let me announce who my guy is right here? Super Bowl champion. The best, again, I say, without equivocation. The best cornerback, defensive back in NFL history, that's Mr. Rod Woodson. Now, if you want to argue that, we can argue that on another day. But there's no question about that. And I think many of the fans would chime in and agree with me with that one as well. Also, Wendell Tyler, man. Number 26, used to run the ball for the San Francisco 49ers. Never really a Niner fan, but he used to get down with the Niners. I don't know if he might have been a little bit before your time, man, but he might. I don't know if you saw him get down or not.
Oh, no, I definitely saw him get down, and I saw his son go to SC as a, entitled legacy player, and didn't quite pan out the same way Wendell did. Wendell was filthy, had a little bit of a fumbling problem, but, no, he was filthy in his time.
Did his son, is he done at USC or is he still there? What's the deal?
Oh, my gosh. His son was one of the ones that started the whole, players getting paid scandal at SC. Perhaps getting their TMZ catching him on a night where he had a few too many libations. And the reason he said he loved SC so much is because they pay him.
Really, really young Tyler.
That really happened. Young Tyler, yes.
It really, he lived in Bellevue, so he didn't know no better. He grew up in Bellevue. He thought they was getting taken care of every block, I guess. Huh?
Yes, absolutely. And that wasn't supposed to be a secret. So that was like the double negative.
Yeah, okay. See what happens, man? When you take too much care, too good of care of them, you see what happens? How about
indeed.
How about number 77? With it being week 77 of the podcast, what about number 77? Who wore that number best to you, or who first comes to my mind, or to your mind?
Who first comes to my mind, Cam? And this is for my 206 homies. A cat that had a very short time with the Seattle SuperSonics, but was very impactful. A guy named Vladimir Radmanovich.
Okay, that's a good one. That's a good one. Black Rat got a championship though with the Lakers.
Sure did.
With your Lakers, Black Rat. Couple guys come to my mind. Couldn't decide which one, but Jacob Green. Excuse me, Jeff Bryant. I always got them confused, just as I did right now. Jacob Green, Jeff Bryant. I always got them confused. They were part of that Chuck Knox defensive line. I thought they were stout defensive. And then why isn't Jeff Bryant in the Hall of Fame, man? Or I guess they didn't win a bowl. That I'm asking Mr. Super Bowl guy. I guess they didn't win a Super Bowl, so that's why he wouldn't be in there. Jeff Green was solid, man. Big fan of Jeff Green, defensive tackle for the Seattle Seahawks. And Lyle Alzado. I will credit Lyle Alzado for being part of the reason I never took steroids. When I saw Lyle Alzado walk across the stage on the Dave Letterman show, and he looked, I remember him being a Raider, crazy Raider, looked like he was 6'9", 400 pounds, solid steel and chiseled dude. And then I saw him walk across the stage on Dave Letterman. He looked like he was 6'1", 177. And he was admitting that he took steroids, and that's kind of what happened to his body and deteriorated. I was like, no, it's not worth it. This is the reason that I didn't like needles anyway, so I wasn't going to stick my arm in some – I wasn't going to – you know, shoot myself up with some needles, but that was the reason. It came across about the high school time. It came across in the locker room a couple of times, man. I just wasn't going to stick myself. Now, if they gave me a pill, I might have took the pill. Or they let me soak my feet, I might have soaked my feet. But I wasn't going to stick myself with the needle into my veins to get these steroids. But a lot of guys were doing it, and all I could think of was Lyle Alzado, man. I saw that when I was about 11 or 12. It was like, never, never would I do that. And I don't know if you remember that episode on David Letterman when he walked across the stage, man, just as feeble as could be. That was a pretty good message to me. Do you recall that?
You know, I don't recall that one, but I recall one almost as impactful is that there used to be a cat called Roy Firestone. He used to do a show called Up Close on ESPN, and okay. Lyle Alzado went on that show and just kind of spilled the beans with regards to kind of how he had gotten around the tests and how he could have still been eligible to play, and just the regret he had, and just especially at that time, the harm that performance-enhancing drugs would have on you definitely rang true with him. And like you're saying, for a lot of, just young athletes, it was just kind of a wake-up call as to, these are the, precautions you need to take with regards to, the rest of your life. And this is the ultimate impact it could have. So, and unfortunately for him, he was an example of what not to do and why not to do it. But like you're saying, it definitely rang true with a lot of players.
Yeah, it certainly rang true with me. That was a lasting memory I had, you know, and very impressionable at that age. Like I say, I was 11 or 12, very impressionable. Loved the game, and would at that time I would have done anything to continue to play the game, anything. And again, if they gave me a, if they said you can take the pill, you can drink this juice, or you can, I just wasn't going to shoot myself up for it. But if they gave me a different way, I would have probably taken something. And that was a good example, man. When I seen that guy, it was like wow. It was pretty wild and crazy. Anyway, man, we had a heavyweight championship fight. The WBO championship was on the line last week in Las Vegas. The atmosphere was bananas. The stars came out for that one. I actually recognized Mike Tyson. Lennox Lewis was there, as he is always at the big fights. Evander Holyfield was there. Didn't get a chance to interact with Evander. But we saw Mr. Tyson Fury. He said it for two months now. He's going to take the fight right to Deontay Wilder. He's going to try to knock him out in two rounds. And it looked like to me that Deontay Wilder didn't believe him. He totally ignored him. And he definitely did not prepare for Tyson Fury taking the fight to him. He definitely did not prepare for that. Because as soon as the bell as soon as you heard the bell, Tyson Fury was on that ass, sticking and moving, and his little faint punch caught Deontay a few good times, man, really stuck him. And although I think the hit or the punch where he actually knocked him down in the third round, I thought that was behind the ear. Kind of knocked off his equilibrium, messed him up for the rest of the fight, and he could never recover from that. Kind of similar to what happened to Joshua against Ruiz in that first fight. That once he got hit behind the ear, you know, all the bad habits and everything else came to play and kind of just reared and showed its ugly head. You know, he wanted to blame it on the 40-pound suit that he was wearing. I mean, come on, man. You got your ass kicked, bro. Stop that. How did you see the fight? That's what I saw. Once he got that equilibrium knocked off in the third round, he couldn't recover. He did not have, you know, boxers, when they're in trouble, they go to hug. They go to clinch and try to buy some time. Tyson Fury was not only hitting them as he was coming in to clinch, he was hitting them on the break. That's why he got the point taken away. But he was hitting them as they're clinching. He was hitting in the clinch, as they're clinching, and coming out of the clinch. And Wilder didn't just have those skills to combat that. He didn't know how to – it looked like to me he didn't know how to hit in the clinch or going into the clinch. He didn't know how to punch while they're clinching. And he didn't know how to punch coming out of the clinch or avoid those punches. And that caused a lot of problems for him because those are the times that Fury was taking the energy out of him. Because you saw the second knockdown was just a punch to the midsection. That wasn't really supposed to knock you out, but it was a punch to the midsection that knocked him down. And then do you agree with the stoppage? What do you think of the fight? Talk to us, Cleveland. Let us know what your thoughts were.
Well, to be quite honest with you, I had to reflect. Remember when was the last time I was this upset by the outcome of a boxing match? And I had to go all the way back to Roy Jones Jr. getting knocked out the first time. I mean, that was like, wow. Like just seeing Roy just laid out on the canvas, not able to get up, was just completely shocking. In my mind, I had no doubt that Deontay Wilder was going to win this fight. I had no doubt that he was going to knock Tyson Fury out. I had listened to all of the experts, all of the pundits just say basically echoing the same thing. And so I thought it was basically a foregone conclusion. I thought that we were just going to see an opportunity for Deontay Wilder to just add to his legacy. Shame on me for disregarding all the other things, all of the other warning signs that were out there. A, Tyson Fury 6'9", 270 pounds. That weighs you by 40 pounds at the weigh-in. That's not to even mention what it might look like at the actual fight night. Shame on me for just completely throwing the fact out that Deontay Wilder is not a very good boxer. If we're being honest, he's kind of a one-trick pony. If he can hit you with the thunderous right hand, you're going down, and you're probably never getting up. Tyson Fury being one of the few people that were able to do that at 256, and then he put on an extra 15 pounds. I mean, my goodness. And then just to see the way that Tyson Fury was able to execute his plan, which he had been saying the whole time that I had just been disregarding as just nonsense, and everything that he said came to fruition, and he beat him exactly the way he said he was going to do it. So it was just all kind of very melancholy after the fight. The excuse about wearing the costume into the ring and how long he had to wear it, so on and so forth. I mean, if you're a multimillionaire, you kind of have to, I would assume you tried the costume on before. I'm hoping this isn't just the first time that you tried it on. And if it is, again, shame on you for you're going to have to wear, like, basically armor for, like, 45 minutes before you get to the ring. Adrenaline's going, emotions are pumping. That's not wise. Next time, maybe just wear a robe, huh?
Like Mike Tyson. Yeah, that's what we're going to love to see. Him come in there with a spear and a robe. Hey, I'm hunting for my kill. That's what he should come into the ring with. His ring walk was pretty elaborate. I did like how they had the silhouettes or the pictures of the history of, for Black history and the different people, the different Rosa Parks, Sojourner Truth, the different people that he was giving props to as he entered the ring. However, the outfit was a little over top. Shame on you, like you say, if you didn't try that on it before. He had D-Smoke. He played just probably 3 weeks ago, the Clipper game on Thursday night, the Laker game on Friday night. He played an event in Vegas earlier in the year that I saw him, so I'm familiar with D-Smoke, got a chance to meet him and know the DJ and all that, so that was pretty cool, all Black everything. But Deontay Wilder, man, you got to be ready for the fight, bro. You got to be ready for the big-time fight, man. You can't come in here trying some stuff you ain't tried before. Got to be ready for the fight. Tyson Fury took it to him, man. So I'm not buying the excuses that he gave. He said he gives all credit to Fury, but then, immediately says his legs wasn't right, stuff wasn't right in his corner. Come on, man. Cut that out, bro. Did you think it was a good stoppage by Mark Breland, or would you like to see the fight continue?
The last time I saw a stoppage like this was when Buddy McGirt, a former champion, was the trainer for Arturo Gatti, and he threw in the towel when Floyd Mayweather was making a mockery of him. And when Arturo Gatti came to him and said, "Why did you stop it?" He said, "Because I love you too much to let you keep getting beat up like this, and we're not going to win this fight." Mark Breland, an Olympic champion, a two-time champion, felt the same way. I mean, what was going to be the outcome of just letting him stay out there? It was at a point in the fight where really, again, this is 6'9", 270 pounds. a direct shot to your face and you're very susceptible to it at the time, then why let that happen? Because Deontay Wilder says, man, you just got to let me die here in the ring. I'm a warrior. Man, come on, man. There's other fights, man. You have a life to live after this. He did the right thing.
Yeah, he can't fault him too much. He knows the court. He knows his guys. He saw what was going on. He's experienced. He's probably the most experienced guy outside of Sugar Hill. And it was I was happy for Sugar Hill, Javon Sugar Hill Stewart, to kind of get that W. I was happy in the sense that it actually legitimized. He has a name now instead of being Emmanuel Stewart's nephew. You know, all leading up to the fight, it was Emmanuel Stewart's nephew where Tyson Fury is going to go train at. It wasn't Sugar Hill, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't Javon Stewart who he's going to learn from. And this fight actually gave him a name. So I was happy for him in that regard. I got a chance to talk to him a few minutes after the fight, after the press conference. So I got some. Check me on YouTube, Voice of the Fans on YouTube. You'll see my interview with Javon Sugar Hill Stewart, where he talks to, well, I asked him, like, what else can you do? One of the questions I asked, or one of the conversations I had with Tommy the Hitman Hearns was, I asked Tommy, what makes this gym, Kronk gym, so reputable, such a quality gym that you would, somebody from England would want to come over there and train in the gym? And he said, like, it's the people in the gym. And then I also asked him, Tyson Fury, you can only teach him so much in such amount of short time to prepare for the fight. How much of that can he retain? You know, as the old saying goes, you got your game plan. Everybody has a plan until they get hit in the mouth. How long can, as a boxer, how long can he maintain that same game plan and then use what he was taught? So I asked Tommy the Hitman those questions. After the fight, I got a chance to ask Sugar Hill those questions. How much can you give now to Fury? What's left that you can do better? He said, oh, man, we can get better. We can get faster. We can get stronger. Talking to a lot of boxers over the weekend, Sean Porter, Lennox Lewis, Derek James, who's a trainer now. My main questions were to these guys, can you improve your punching power? It's like, B, either you have it or you don't. Can you improve your punching power? That is my thought. Just, you know, wanted to know from these guys who've been in the ring, these guys who have that intimate experience, how do you improve your punching power? Well, Lennox Lewis gave me an all-out demonstration of how one can improve his punching power. And it's not so much speed or lifting weights or getting stronger. It's the accuracy, the way you deliver your punches can make your punches more powerful. Now you're not rearing them back all the way behind your ear. It's just a quick pull it up to your chin and throw it out there. And more of a direct shot. That's how you improve your punching power, which was pretty impressive. Because we're in this meeting room, and I asked Lennox Lewis his questions, and he got all excited because now he can give a demonstration. That's what he likes to do. He likes to train, and he likes to train boxers. His way of training is showing them, not really telling them. You could tell people how to do it, but he likes showing you how you could do it. So he tapped me in the chest a couple times and then punched me in the chest. And it was like, oh, okay, Lennox, come on now. I'm not a champion, big fella. So it was kind of funny, but it was cool. I mean, that's the type of Lennox. Lennox is a good guy like that, but. He flicked at me, and then punched me, and I was like, oh, shit, okay. And then it was funny because that's what I saw Fury do in the ring. It was faint punch. Faint with the left. Fake the left, and then unload with the right. And he got, if you look at that fight again, he got Wilder a few times like that, fake with the left, fake with the left, and then boom. And it was, you know, again, kind of knocked him off his guard. So it was the way you deliver that punch. And that was a big question for me going into the fight night with the, all these guys, all these boxers I had in front of me. How do you improve your punching power? And you don't improve the power. You just improve the delivery, which is going to give you more power. So that was pretty cool. It was pretty interesting. As we know now, Wilder has accepted the rematch clause, I should say. As we knew he would. Where else are you going to go to make $30 million? But do you want to see the rematch?
I do want to see it. I don't necessarily think that I am expecting or predicting a different result. I think that Tyson Fury has kind of got him figured out, and Deontay Wilder is really used to fighting with, you know, shorter dudes. So it's very infrequent that he fights someone that he is looking eye to eye with or even looking up at. So I think that he has been exposed. Again, he is always a thunderous right hand away from winning a fight, which is one of the things that makes him so exciting. But I think that a lot of the flaws in his boxing game were exposed, and I'm not sure that there's enough time to rectify those and make it an interesting fight. But, I mean, it will always be an interesting fight again because of the thunderous right hand that can land at any time, but I'm not quite sure if the results will be any different.
Well, a lot of people have that same train of mind that you have, like, they're explaining it a way like that. I like to say that if Fury can improve his game over a matter of a couple months, why can't Deontay improve his game over the same time frame? So he does have to go to the drawing board. He does have to – now, he's fought a couple fights back-to-back-to-back because he just fought in November. Before then, he fought, I think it was in June. So he hasn't really had much time off. If he turns around and fights 3 months from now, that's going to be May – or June, that's still going to be not give him a lot of time to rest, but except now he has a different motivation in regaining his title, so that's going to encourage him and inspire him to fight a little harder, maybe, or improve his game that much. So we'll see how that transpires there. 21, let's take a quick break here. Saving too, guys. Thanks for your time. Thank you for tuning in once again. Cleveland, thank you for your feedback. We've got the NFL making some moves this week. The owners are trying to pull a fast one on the players. Some of the players are going for it. Some of the veterans aren't. What's your thoughts on this collective bargain agreement from the NFL? Do you think the players should be asking? I had an interesting comment from your guy, Jason Whitlock, by the way, who said the players should be asking for it. Lifetime medical benefits. And they shouldn't agree to this deal unless they get lifetime medical benefits, regardless of the money they got. But the players say they want less practice and they want to be able to smoke weed. And they want to exolve Commissioner Roger Goodell from making disciplinary calls. They want to turn that over to somebody else. Well, Roger Goodell says, I want lifetime medical, and I want a jet to fly my family around town, around the country, around the world if need be. The players, you know, that's a different mindset that you can see, a generational difference in the mindset that these guys have. What's your thoughts on the collective bargaining agreement, and do you think we're going to see a strike, or will we have football as usual come September?
A couple different things going on there, Cam. For one, I do agree with your guy, Mr. Whitlock. I think that lifetime medical benefits is a great idea for a certain level of service time within the NFL. I think that's one of the problems that players have, is that after they leave a team and they're used to getting these I mean, just like with everyone, I mean, imagine if you had to get certain medication without benefits. I mean, it's the price, you know, goes up exponentially. And for some of the things that these players have to take and some of the things that they're used to taking, unfortunately, on a weekly basis are no longer at their disposal. That's kind of when their health starts to deteriorate. So I definitely think that that's a good idea. Was never a big fan of the odd number of games, 17-game season. Sounds very weird. How do you make that work? Pretty odd. I thought that the little wrinkle were in just the top seed in each conference gets a bye and not the two teams. I guess just to add that extra weekend of drama and intrigue was kind of interesting. But the NFL has always shown, or to this point has shown, that it is the haves and the have-nots, and the players that are more fixated on a three-year window adverse superstar status have a different opinion of how things are going to look and play out because of how long they figure their career is going to be within the league. So they're on different sides of, they're on different opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to how they really differentiate certain things within the collective bargaining agreement. Do I think that they would have one? I do. It's just one of those things where the NFL Players Union is not that strong and their leverage is not that great. And the goose laying the golden egg is laying a really big golden egg and they want a part of it. So it will get done. There will be some players at the top that are very adamant that this is not a very good deal long-term. You guys are thinking short-term, but then you have to remember most players, their career is very short term. So I think eventually it will get done. I think that they clear a lot of hurdles getting to the finish line, and that it's more in the language and the semantics of how things lay out as far as what the players are going to want. And I think the owners are committed to acquiescing on most of those things. So I think eventually it will get done and we won't see any work stoppage.
Well, that's all I care about right now at this point, is I don't care about the work stoppage. Lifetime medical, I think that's an aggressive call. The way you put it there, is that after 6 years in the league, you get lifetime or 7 years, whatever that number be, I agree that plays a part. That would be doable. But just for anybody who comes and plays in the NFL, again, you know my stance on CTE, so this is right along with that stance on CTE. Lifetime medical, if you're a super veteran, you've been in the league 8, 9, 10 years, okay, I agree with you. Your issues aren't going to show up till later down in the road, if at all. But they couldn't do lifetime benefits for everybody who didn't make it to their second contract. I mean, the league probably, that would be a challenge to the NFL. There's few challenges to the NFL, but that would be a major challenge to the NFL. So you heard my heated conversation with Mr. TJ Houshmandzadeh. And as I've been telling you, you see fans, if you check me out, Voice of the Fans on YouTube, I got an interview with TJ Houshmandzadeh. I got a lot of interviews with some of the boxers who around the game that were clearly there in Vegas last week talking about the fight. I just try to educate myself. If I don't know, I try to, you know, find out somebody who does know, read up on it, whatever I need to do so I can educate myself. However, Mr. Cleveland, you see, my stance hasn't changed, right? My stance doesn't change on CTE. That's my next conversation with Marcellus Wiley, by the way. If you saw that, I had a great interview with Marcellus Wiley. I needed to get some clarification on his position with Colin Kaepernick and some topics that he had said months ago. I just hadn't had a chance to talk to him. So when we talked to him, he was really cool up front. allowed me to challenge his thinking, and, you know, we came to the agreement, and he clarified some things for me. So that was cool. My next conversation is going to be CTE with him. So you know my position on CTE, Levon. You know my stance doesn't change just because I hear somebody else say it. So you know how I feel about Joe Burrow and Tua Tagovailoa. Although Coach Mangiato was surprised I felt that way and clearly didn't feel as I feel, my thoughts didn't change because of his thoughts. He played in the NFL. I grant him that, but I saw football. I know what that looks like. And still, I say to this day, as Water would say, I'm not taking Tua in my first in the top 10. If he's at 13 with the Dolphins pick at 13, I'll take him there. I'm not taking him in the top 10. So my question is not who would you take him or not. My question to you today is who will have the better career, Joe Burrow or Tua Tagovailoa?
Well, for our fans out there that were not fortunate enough to see the interview with TJ Houshmandzadeh and some of the other great work that Cameron has done with some very high-end, top-name athletes, you should have seen the look on Cameron Buford's face when a multiple Pro Bowl receiver said, oh, yeah, Tua is the truth. I would 100% take him. This dude's face got bloodshot red, and he could barely contain himself. I thought I saw Cameron Buford bite his own tongue off. He was that, like, shocked and taken aback that someone with such talent and had that much experience in the league would say, oh, yeah, Tua is the truth, and completely dispel all of the misnomers that Cameron has had about Tua going to the Dolphins. That being said, the question is, and you guys got to see the interview, fans. That being said, the question was who will have the better career completely depends on the resources and the utilities that are put around these quarterbacks. No quarterback, I don't care how good you are, if you don't have talent and you don't have an organization that's functional, can function at a high level. If you have that, you're much more apt to succeed. We've seen lots of quarterbacks in adverse environments that get to the right place and they flourish. Who's going to have a better career? It's completely up in the air. There's no way to know who's going to have the better career at this point until we see the other things that are around them. Who has the more talent? Who has the more potential? Well, I would kind of lean towards Burrow. However, the situation may be better for Tua in Miami. So we won't know until we see those other things.
And that's fair enough. That's fair enough. I will say right now, I put my call into Flores last week and said, Flores, here, let's agree to this deal. Let's send our number 5. Let's send our number 13 pick and a second or third round, whichever we can get away with next year, whichever the Bengals would accept. Our 5 this year, our number 13 pick, and a 3 or third or second round pick next year, whichever one, again, we can get away with. I'd package those and send them to Cincinnati so we can move up 4 spots to take Burrow. That's what I would do. I told
okay, you that. Well, that's wishful thinking. That's what? Not happening.
What?
Because Cincinnati wants their franchise quarterback and they want the person who they think is a generational quarterback. So that's not happening. What you should be saying to yourself is, let's hope that Tua is not that dude, and you end up like all those general managers and have to explain why they passed on Patrick Mahomes. You don't want to be in the room having that conversation, Cam. And he's right there with the five. I mean, the five is not that high.
I can't take somebody who had a broken
five,
two
is
broken
not that
ankles.
High for a franchise quarterback.
I can't take somebody who had two broken ankles, a broken hip. I cannot take them with the five. I need immediate production. Whether I go quarter, whether I go running back, whether I go receiver.
Why do you need immediate production? What you want is a franchise quarterback. Fitzpatrick for one more year is just fine.
Fitzpatrick for one more year, four wins.
Got five last year, beat the Patriots.
Man, come on, stop it, man. When you try to sell me on Fitzpatrick, stop it. You're not buying up Fitzpatrick yourself.
No, what I'm buying is you have all these concerns about Tua and his injury issues. I'm okay with Tua sitting for a year. There was a time when your starting quarterback sitting for a year or two really wasn't that big of a deal and was kind of expected, so that they kind of learned the ropes and knew how to perform when they actually got their opportunity, a.k.a. Patrick Mahomes. So, man, I'm okay with Tua sitting. I have no idea concerning what you could get in the future.
I mean, come on, man. I'm not. So another season of tanking is what you're proposing, and we two of them.
No, what I'm proposing is a season of your quarterback learning behind a veteran quarterback. You don't. There's no rush to throw him out there if he's not ready. And like you said, he's already recovering from a hip and two ankle injuries. So, man, your team is not that good. Why are you trying to throw him out there right now just to get more damage done to him? Let him sit behind a veteran quarterback, learn some things, and Fitzpatrick will give you, I mean, you know, not to diss, but he'll give you lots of opportunities to be like, yeah, that's why you don't really throw that pass.
We get four to five games. By week nine, I'm going to want to see the rookie quarterback. I mean, by week nine, we're going to be 3-6. Talking about, okay, is the rookie healed? Has he grasped some playbook? Is he ready to play? I mean, come on. We already know what's going to happen. Where did he
week, week, week 13, week 13 would be a good time for him to come out there and get a C-Lack.
And play four games. We're gonna have three wins in week 13, and expect the young guy to come in there and do something. Come on, man. Stop it, man.
Consider yourself fortunate. You got your franchise quarterback, and then you have a very high draft choice the next year. In addition to all of the other picks that you've accumulated, trading all of your talent away.
You have an
opportunity to build a foundation.
You guys keep saying franchise quarterback. I'm not sold, man. I'm not sold on it. And plus he's injured. And plus he's shown that he's injury prone. I'm not convinced. You know when you go to the store and you buy your bag of nachos, your bag of Mission tortilla chips. I want the bag that's still untouched, that allows you to break your own chips up. I don't want the bag that's been on the bottom of the barrel that's already broken up and every chip you come out is you're getting crumbs. That's not the bag I want. I want the full bag of chips. I want to break my own chips, okay? I don't want somebody's broken chips. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, and I'm saying, fans, if you think you're not serious about this, you need to check out the TJ Houshmandzadeh interview. Because when he said that, his face went bloodshot red, and he could barely contain himself. But a multiple Pro Bowl receiver has said, yeah, he throws a nice ball, and I would love to play with that dude. And even make a comparison between Burrow and Tua as if they were Jade Epson and Halle Berry. It was kind of crazy. Like, you just can't go wrong with either one. So, yeah, check that one out. It was a great interview.
That was funny.
I know Cam is still fuming about it because he felt that he wasn't validated in his opinion of Tua and forgetting that Tua's won a national championship and replaced a quarterback that had only lost one game in two seasons and just flourished it. I mean, with the 5 pick, understanding, and this is another interesting point, Cam, because we went through this exercise. What two positions have the biggest bust rate? Quarterback and defensive lineman. With the 5 pick, you might as well roll the dice, man. And if you end up with the 5 pick next year, oh well, you roll the dice.
Man, and that's it. It's easy to say that from a person who has Russell Wilson as their quarterback. Okay, it's easy.
Yes. Russell Wilson the third round.
And then this is again the other conversation fans that we have, but Cleveland wants to conveniently forget is that you can find quality talent later in the draft. You just have to do a little homework.
Fans ever so rarely, and yeah. Cam is looking for a needle in a haystack, and those are hard to find. Might as well just try and get to the top, and, you know, since we have one of those top picks, use it and see what you got.
Man, again, we had this conversation.
Tua in teal. Hashtag Tua in teal.
Listen to this guy. Well, we're going to see what's going on. Big guy. So one more NFL question. Mike McCarthy, does he change the Cowboys around and get them in the playoffs this season?
Yes.
You say yes. He's worth 4 games that were 8-8 last year, so they'll win 10 games, 11 games. You know, provide all the back.
No, Cam, they play in the NFC East, so they'll only have to win one more game. or the same amount of games and just win the tiebreaker. They'll be okay.
Wow. So you don't have them improving much at all. They'll win by default is what you're saying.
They play in the worst division in the NFL. So, yes, I don't think it's difficult to win that division, and I think that they will have an opportunity to do so with a different voice and a different direction.
Okay, that'll be interesting to see how what happens there. Okay, let's take a quick break here, Mr. Cleveland. When we come back, we're going to talk about some NBA topics and this day back in history.
The people at What's Good in Sports want to talk to you, talk to the fans, and make sure you guys tune into the website. Cleveland, have you seen What's Good in Sports website?
Yeah, it's beautiful, man. Lots of positive stories and lots of great content.
The people there told me personally, make sure you guys go visit the website. So please, when you get a chance after the show, check out the What's Good in Sports.com website.
Mr. Cleveland, last week, those Los Angeles Clippers before the NBA All-Star game, All-Star break, actually, they picked up Mr. Marcus Morris. Last week, they went ahead and finally got the point guard I've been saying they need, and Mr. Reggie Jackson. What's your thoughts on that pickup?
My thoughts were that the Los Angeles Clippers were trying to put together the All-Medusa team with guys like Patrick Beverley and Reggie Jackson, breaking cameras.
Don't look at us wrong. Don't look at us wrong, buddy. I tell you that. Don't look at the Clippers
However, if this was Reggie Jackson from 3 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, great move. But someone that has been sitting in purgatory in Detroit, I don't know if you've looked at Detroit's roster lately, but I actually did look at it today. It is, dreadful. So the fact that he could get no scratch over there is kind of puzzling. And where he thinks he's going to get all these minutes, in Clipperland with a team that has championship aspirations, I don't know. I mean, hopefully somebody to kind of spell the point guard, you know, spot for a few minutes here or there. But, wow, is he the piece of the puzzle that puts you over the top? Don't think so.
Well, you know, let me tell you what he does. Let me break this down for you and all the fans listening. I've been saying now for a year and a half the Clippers needed a pass-first point guard. Well, they didn't actually get a pass-first point guard with Reggie Jackson. They got somebody who can score, somebody who can get his own shot. They got somebody, most importantly, who can relieve Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, Mr. Sixth Man of the Year, Sweet Lou. They got somebody who can relieve them, these guys, of the ball handling duties. So now, bring it up the court, they can pass it to a fresh Kawhi. He can pass it to a fresh Paul George. They don't make them guys work so hard, overexert them, because we want to just use him to get the ball to our scores. To the scores of the Clippers, I should say. Okay, so there's a good purpose for the
you can go ahead and say our scores. That's fine. You're all in. You're vested, so that's okay.
They also in getting Marcus Morris, they get another big who can defend, who can switch. He's versatile enough, he can switch defenders. And I don't know if you noticed, but there's only one team who has 3 7-footers on their squad. Only one team in the league like that. So the rest of the guys that there are going to be, you know, 6'11". Marcus Morris can handle a lot of those guys. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that or not, and familiar with his capabilities. And the funny question that I asked Montrezl Harrell in the locker room the other day, asked Montrezl, how familiar were you with Marcus Morris before you joined the squad? He's like, well, he put up 40 on us a couple of weeks ago, so I'm pretty aware of what he can do. Meaning he knows he can score. Meaning he knows he's that tough guy. He's another dog that they have in the locker room. So this is Lawrence Frank called them the all blacktop team earlier in the year. This is all the all chain net team. All these guys play with chain net. All that means the street courts, if you're not familiar with it, Mr. Cleavon. That means that all these tough guys over here who's not crying for a whistle when he drives to the hoop, when somebody drives to the bucket and gets a lay-in, gets touched by Lonzo Ball and they want a foul. This is an all tough guy team over here. So when the going gets tough, you know what they say, the tough gets going. And that's what I expect to see from these Clippers. Do you think Zion Williamson is even in the rookie of the year conversation?
Zion Williamson is not in the rookie of the year conversation.
Okay, that's something we agree upon there. That's something we actually agree upon right there. I don't agree either. He's looked good, although he just hasn't played enough games. Secondly, Cleavon, can a player win most improved player 2 years in a row? I'm thinking at Pascal Siakam. You know,
Cam, I'm glad that you brought this question up because my answer is twofold. I will first give you my answer, and then I will give you who I think the comeback player of the year really should be.
Okay.
So, first of all, hell no. You can't be comeback player of the year 2 years in a row.
Most improved. Most improved player.
Hell no. You can't be most improved player of the year 2 years in a row. You came back. You were improved. People see you can ball. It's like, oh, okay. You can ball.
But it takes you to that level. You
made the list now. You're on the radar. Okay? Good for you. Now, with regards to who should be the comeback player / most improved player of the year, He's a guy that plays in your home city. A guy named LeBron James.
Oh.
A guy that missed the playoffs last year.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Missed the last 25 games.
What?
Hadn't played a game, I think, since like March 13th of last year before the season started. And now has a team with the number one seed in the Western Conference. The toughest conference in all of sports, the Western Conference in the National Basketball Association, and leads the league in assists.
Excuse this fantasy, guys.
Who else can do that? Who can fall from grace that low to where they were wondering whether he was even a top 15 player people were questioning?
Oh, my goodness.
Can he even be invited to play on the Olympic team, people were saying. He's all washed up. He just turned it around. He's done a complete 180 in front of everybody. It's amazing to watch. Is it not, Cam?
This is one of the most homerish opinions you've had in our 7 years of doing this show. You actually seriously want to give LeBron James the most improved player of the year?
Have you seen the way he's improved? Have you seen the way he's improved his game?
Oh, my goodness.
The versatility that he's shown, the level of which he was at last year, it's going to need to make the playoffs last year. Damn. They're the number one seed in the Western Conference division of the National Basketball Association.
I would say you have to play a season to be eligible for the most improved. I mean, he didn't even play last year. So, I mean, he played like 26% of the season. This guy,
he played, come on, man.
This guy, oh, my goodness. LeBron James, huh? Your comeback player of the year. Oh, my goodness gracious. If that's not the most homerous call right there, opinion you've had, what a take that was. But I need some feedback from you fans. And please answer this question. Where can they find you on this question to send all replies to this man, Cleveland Young Sam Beal? How can they find you?
Absolutely, Cam. They can find me at Cleve Wonder on Twitter and Cleveland Steele on Instagram. Please reach out.
To make it even more simple, find me on Voice of the Fans or at What's Good in Sports. Voice of the Fans, Voice of Fans on Instagram at What's Good in Sports. And tell me or tell us who should be the NBA most improved player. If I get two LeBron James responses, I'll buy you a drink, Cleveland.
There it is. Oh, you're going to get those two.
All right, big guy. As we always do, this day back in history, 225-1870, Hiram Revels, first black senator, took oath of office. Excuse me. Blah, 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 blah. Hiram Revels, first black senator, took oath of office back in 1872-227, Charlotte Ray was the first black woman lawyer, graduated from HU, Howard University, back on 227-1872. Been a long time. In 1935, February 26th, the New York Yankees released Babe Ruth. Ruth signed with the Boston Braves for a piddly $20,000 and some shares in the team's profits. So probably got the beer or something. A piddly $20,000, which obviously was a lot of money back then in those days. In 1985, something you may remember, Mr. Cleveland, 226, Julius the Doctor became the third on the NBA's all time scoring list. So made it to number three. What is that? Probably 7 or 8, isn't he? Probably took a fall. Mr. Cleveland, what can you tell me about Sabrina Ionescu? I don't think I'm saying that right, but
she is a baller. She is a Pac-12 athlete, played at the University of Oregon, but her game is dynamic. She has an all-around game, points, assists, rebounds. Has been breaking records. I think she has more triple doubles than anyone that's ever played. So, yeah, she's the real deal.
Sabrina has 26 triple doubles. The previous record, male or female, in college basketball was 12. So she doubled that up. Sabrina is also the only player, male or female, in NCAAs to have 2,000 points, 1,000 rebounds, and 1,000 assists, male or female. She's the only one that's done that ever. So she's pretty solid. Let me tell you, as she's out there breaking her records on Monday night, Tuesday night. Sitting in the Clippers or the Staples Center in the media room watching the basketball game amongst some other reporters in there. The conversation, she's up in the top, there's 5 TVs, she's in the top left TV doing her thing. Now, that was the same day, if you recall, that Kobe had his memorial service, or they had the memorial service for Kobe and Gigi and the others that perished in the plane accident. God bless them all. And Sabrina was on stage that morning in Los Angeles giving shout out to Kobe for his interest in women's basketball. And later that night, obviously, played in the game, played at Stanford. So the question became, in the media center, how did she get from L.A. to Stanford in such a short amount of time? Obviously, she flew on a plane. But who paid for that plane ticket? This is amongst reporters. This is how shit gets started, big guy. Amongst reporters, as we're having dinner, watching basketball, talking mess to each other, the question comes up, how did she get from L.A. to the Bay Area in time for basketball that evening? The NCAA looked the other way, allowed her to fly on a plane. She was there with Steph Curry, and who also was in the Bay Area. Did they ride the flight together? Did she jump on Steph Curry's private jet? If so, that's a violation of NCAA rules. Is that worth looking into? Try to find out how exactly she got there? Or are we breaking news here? Are we doing investigative reporting? This is a conversation, Cleveland, going around in the media center amongst writers. This how stuff gets broke, man. People are just trying to have a conversation and figure out how actually she got from L.A. to the Bay Area for that game with Stanford. I just thought that was, like, why are you guys thinking about that? Was one my first thought. Secondly, are you guys really going to dig into this? Is it really that critical that we find out how she got from L.A. to the Bay? This is what goes on. And just to kind of shed some light, pull the curtain back, fans, on what goes on as we're covering the game. This was a conversation. Your thoughts on this, Cleveland?
Sure. I will take this back to the early 90s. There was a player before all of the Fab Five scandal broke out. This is a little bit after the Fab Five's time. there was a player that played for the University of Michigan called Robert Tractor Trailer. He was injured, but I saw him sitting on the bench in a Coogee sweater and a thick, huge Figaro chain around his neck. And I thought to myself, scholarship athlete, that's awfully flossy, considering that you can't earn any money. No one said anything, kind of looked the other way, and that was that. I've watched numerous NCAA basketball tournaments where the first thing they talk about is how adverse this player's environment has been their entire life, but their parents are at every game sitting within 20 rows of the court. How did they get there? No one ever really asked these questions. No one should really ask this question about Sabrina. You really want to know? Her grandparents in Nebraska buy the tickets, prepaid for them, and that's all you need to know. You start digging into stuff like that, it will never, ever end.
Yeah, I just found it interesting. I don't care either way. I just thought it was interesting how these guys, I mean, if this went on for a solid hour, asking questions. One guy's a salary guru. The other guy is in professional ranks. Nobody's a college reporter, so that's why it was just a question and nobody had answers. One guy's a salary guru.
That's a completely legitimate observation. Like I said, those are the two times that I can think of just off the top of my head that I have thought that. Like, how did that happen? So, you can't tell me on the one hand.
LeBron having a Hummer at 15.
You can't tell me on the one end this player's mom works three jobs and has five kids and they don't have a car to get back and forth from practice, and then four games in a row, she's sitting 50 feet from the court. It's like, how did that happen?
Yeah,
couldn't have been from her efforts, right? I mean, it's like, okay. These two things don't make sense. You can't tell me this story and then she's at every arena that this person ever plays a game in. That's contradictory to what you're saying, right?
Yeah, it is. But again, just some questions that kind of come up here in the locker room or rubbing elbows with these reporters. I just found it extremely interesting and one that I thought I'd share with you, with your fans. Cleavon, I know you're in love with Kyrie. I know that's your guy. He was recently announced VP of the Players Union after signing a big deal with the Brooklyn Nets over the winter last winter. And now he's out indefinitely. What's your thoughts on Kyrie?
My thoughts about Kyrie are that he's an extremely talented player, and when he is healthy and focused, he's a huge problem on the court. Other than that, he's kind of exposed himself as a little bit of a weirdo and a little bit of someone that we just can't really wrap our hands around, and we don't really know what to expect from this guy at any given time.
Hey, yeah, that's a great summation. That's a great summation. I couldn't have said it any better. We don't know what to expect from this guy. But, yeah, he'll give us something to talk about, though, because that's what he likes to do. And don't contradict him because he's going to swear he's right. We have Beeline is out in Cleveland. Kind of no surprise. The man saw that coming when he called his locker room a bunch of thugs in there, regardless of how you want to twist it. The man saw that coming. Final question for you, Mr. Cleveland. Does Chris Bosh, is Chris Bosh a Hall of Famer?
In my mind, no, Chris Bosh is not a Hall of Famer. If we're looking at some of the players that have made the Hall of Fame recently, yeah, he probably deserves the nod. He's done his body of work is more extensive than some people that are in the Hall of Fame right now.
Interesting. Interesting that you say that. I'd have to say no. I mean, he may get in 10 years down the line, but today, after being eligible for 5 years, I can't put him in right away. He had some big games. He was a big addition to what the Lakers were trying to do. The Heat were trying to do. He was a big part of that plan. He didn't make it to see the end of the career because of the blood clots. Now, maybe if he continues to play, he might have gained that recognition, but.
Oh, wow. Wow. Wait. So does he not get Hall of Fame consideration because his career was cut a little bit short?
I mean.
You definitely be on the other side of the ledger with some other players. I won't name names specifically. I'll let you do that, Cam. That can't be your argument.
I mean, he played with some certain Hall of Famers, and. He wasn't the...
No. What you said is that the length of his career is what's holding him out of the Hall of Fame. Now, I know you're not really saying that, are you?
No. Again. You need
to walk that back, playboy. You need to walk that back, or we need to have a different conversation about some other players that you have given that endorsement to.
I know exactly who you're talking to, and I'll let him talk to you again right now. I'll play the tape back so he can talk to you again. But Cleveland, he wasn't the major factor in those Heat championships, was he? He got one rebound that we can sit here and say, okay, he was a factor. He made one play and getting Ray on that shot so they can tie the game up against San Antonio. Outside of that, He was the third guy on that team that won championships. So, come on, he a Hall of Famer? I don't know about.
I mean, was James Worthy the third guy on the Lakers? Was Robert Parrish third guy on the Celtics? I mean, it depends on how you look at it.
Did Robert Parrish play defense? Was he the defensive stalwart on those Celtics teams? Was James Worthy the high scorer on that team? On those teams he played with? He was a go-to guy.
I'm just talking about the third best player on those teams, and that's kind of what the argument that you were making. I already said I don't think Chris Bosh is a Hall of Famer.
What I did say was
is there are some people in the Hall of Fame that don't have as extensive a body of work as he does. So from that perspective, he probably should be in there. Maybe not first vote, maybe not first ballot. Okay. But, I mean, how much are you going to kick around with this? You played in a championship 4 straight years, and he's got 2. He's an 8-time All-Star, and his numbers are pretty gaudy in comparison to some other players in there. So, it depends on how you look at that.
He might have to sit for a few years. But we can come back around to the Mr. Chris Bosh deserving to be in the Hall of Fame conversation a lot later. But, yeah, he might have to sit for a few years. Cleveland, let's end the show on this note here. And another quote from Mr. the great Kobe Bryant. The topic of leadership is a touchy one. A lot of leaders fail because they don't have the bravery to touch that nerve or strike that chord. Throughout my years, I haven't had that fear. That is Mr. Kobe Bryant. Cleveland, as always, man, I want to thank you for your participation in the show. Fans, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. And as always, I want to thank you for making our voice your choice.
Hey, it's Peter Rosenberg. I'm hanging out with my man Cameron Buford right here. I just want to say, thank you for making our voice your choice.